Sometime later, King Douglas followed Anne Barclay through the wide, handsomely decorated corridors of the palace and had to hurry to keep up with her. They were heading for the imperial court, and Douglas had a really bad feeling about that. He hadn't been in the main court since his coronation. It seemed to him more and more that all his troubles stemmed from that time. He'd been happy before then, as a paragon, and Louis had still been his friend. They would have died for each other then. Now, here he was, heading towards the court again, and Douglas felt a strange dread, as though his whole life was about to undergo another irrevocable change. He was properly dressed now, in all his kingly robes, with the great cut diamond crown of the empire upon his head. He'd bathed and shaved, and even eaten a hot meal under Anne's watchful eye. And he had to admit he felt better and sharper than he had in ages. He felt almost like himself again. But the bad feeling persisted, and he snatched another sidelong glance at Anne. She still hadn't told him what the hell this was all about. Wouldn't tell him anything. In the past, she would have provided him with a full briefing by now, telling him everything he needed to know, along with carefully worked out answers to the press's most probable queries, and even half a dozen different strategies for dealing with all the various ways to salvage the situation if it all went wrong. And she'd always taken pride in being very good at it. But now she just ignored his questions and stalked along in front of him, her familiar scowl distorting her new beautiful face. People they passed fell back hurriedly to get out of her way. Her way, not his. Douglas didn't miss that. Just another sign of how much things had changed during his seclusion. From the babble of raised voices up ahead, there had to be a whole army of reporters waiting, and not being at all patient about it. As Douglas and Anne slipped through the back door and approached the great hanging curtains that separated them from the court proper, the sound became actually deafening. Douglas frowned.
What the hell can be so important? It doesn't involve Louis or the Terror. It can't be the return of the Blessed Owen.
Anne has no reason to keep that from me.
But then, what reason could Anne have to keep anything from me?
Douglas straightened his shoulders. Whatever it was, the odds were it wasn't going to be good news, so the sooner he faced it, the better. He'd been kept in the dark long enough. He let Anne give him a quick check over to be sure everything was as it should be, and then he nodded sharply to the two waiting guards, who pulled back the curtains so he could make his entrance. He strode out onto the raised dais and settled himself onto his throne, while Anne was still hurrying to catch up. Douglas smiled inwardly. He might have been away, but now he was back, and the sooner everyone recognized that, the better. Time to remind people he was still the king. Perhaps himself, most of all. He looked benignly out over the great wide hall of the court, most of which seemed to be packed full of reporters. Hundreds of remote-controlled cameras floated above the pack, occasionally getting into savage butting contests over the best angles. King Douglas smiled on them all, deliberately ignoring the roar of shouted questions, as he seated himself as comfortably as possible on his ancient throne. There were some cheers at his appearance, but not nearly as many as there should have been. It seemed absence didn't always make the heart grow fonder. And whatever story the mob had been led to expect, it clearly wasn't anything to do with his return. Anne came forwards to stand stiffly beside him, and that was new too. Normally, she stayed well in the background at all public affairs. The hanging curtains parted to reveal the imperial champion, Finn Durandal. He came striding out onto the raised dais, as tall and muscular and classically handsome as always, smiling and nodding affably to the media pack, surrounded by his own personal honor guard of six paragons, grim-faced in their polished armor and dramatic purple cloaks. Finn had never had any trouble looking every inch the hero, though up close his charisma had a cold and calculated feel. And he looked a lot better in the official black leather armor of the champion than Louis Deathstalker ever had. Finn still wore his old purple paragon's cloak over his gleaming armor, as though to show he hadn't forgotten where he came from. He struck a grand pose at the front of the dais and waved and smiled to the media mob.
Thank you, my friends. Thank you, thank you.
Those cheers had once been reserved for only the king. Douglas looked at the six paragons accompanying Finn. They'd spread out in a bodyguard's pattern, studying the reporters with cold, inimical eyes. Douglas had to wonder just what it was that the apparently popular Finn Durandal felt he needed to be protected from so thoroughly. And there was something off about the Paragons. They wore their armor sloppily and carried themselves more like thugs than warriors. And none of them had so much as glanced at Douglas, even though he would have called some of them friends.
What could have happened out on their failed quest to have changed them so harshly?
Finn Durandal smiled graciously out over the court as though he owned it, holding his noble heroic pose with the ease of long practice, allowing the media pack to worship him. Finally, he raised a single hand. The floating cameras all came rushing in for close-ups. A few targeted Douglas as well, just to be sure they didn't miss out on anything. But it was the champion, and not the king, who held everyone's attention. And everyone there knew it.
My friends, today, as I promised you, I bring you the story of the century. No, not the return of the blessed Owen Deathstalker, unfortunately. The great quest continues, but I have to tell you that more and more of our noble paragons are returning disappointed. Instead, I stand here now to inform you of the return of a man almost as legendary, as well-loved, and almost as long-lost. A man long considered dead has been discovered very much alive. A hero, returned to us all in our hour of need. My friends, allow me to introduce to you James Campbell, first son of William and Niamh Campbell, the man born to be king!
For a moment, there was utter silence in the court. And then, a tall and handsome man in kingly robes came striding from behind the curtains and out onto the dais as though he belonged there, and always had. James Campbell stood beside Finn, who shook his hand warmly, and then put a comradely arm across his broad shoulders, while Douglas Campbell sat slumped on his throne as though someone had just punched him under the heart. Deathstalker Return, In the Footsteps of Legends, is a graphic audio production. Copyright 2004, Simon R. Green. Production copyright 2007, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Performed by Richard Rowan, Michael Glenn, David Coyne, Vanessa Benjamin, Sonny Lasky, Corey James, Nanette Savard, Chris Rowan, Dylan Lynch, and Mort Shelby. Directed and adapted for graphic audio by Rick Rowan. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing by Chris Rowan and Johann Detweiler. Graphic audio sound design by Chris Rowan and Dan Smith. The Deathstalker Return theme was composed by Dan Smith. Additional original music by Chris Rowan and Dan Smith. Duet performed by Tess Rowan and Nanette Savard. If you enjoyed Deathstalker Return, be sure to look for the graphic audio version of DC Comics' Infinite Crisis, available at Road Stops Everywhere, at 1-800-670-5220, or at www.graphicaudio.net. Keep listening for the next episode of Mark Dalton, Owner-Operator. Graphic Audio presents Mark Dalton, Owner-Operator, by Ido Van Belkom. Copyright 2007, Ido Van Belkom. Performed by David Coyne and the Graphic Audio Players. Episode 5, Murder on Sight.
The drive back east across the prairies was uneventful, and considering the string of adventures he'd experienced of late, Mark Dalton was grateful for the respite. When he reached Sudbury, he made a call on his cell phone to find out exactly where he was supposed to deliver the wind machines to, and to make sure there would be someone to meet him when he got there later in the day. The movie was being shot in and around Collingwood, and the cast and crew had taken over an inn just a few kilometers away in a town called Nottawa. That's where he was supposed to deliver his load. When he got to the inn around 3 that afternoon, he parked on the road out in front of the place and headed inside. He was on the lookout for Shannon Tweed, the sexy star of the movie, but figured she was probably on the set somewhere, acting up a storm.
I'll call you later.
Still, maybe he'd get lucky. The production company had taken over the inn's lobby, using it like a command center. There was a storyboard on one wall, filming schedules on another, and a few tables with clipboards and other items that looked like they helped keep track of things. But for all the clutter in the room, there wasn't a soul in sight.
Hello? Anybody here? Hello?
From a room off the lobby, he could hear someone talking, probably on a phone because the shouts were punctuated by long pauses. Mark headed for the sound of the voice and ended up in the inn's bar. There was a young man sitting on a stool with a cell phone to his ear. He was talking about a lot of things Mark didn't understand or cared about, since none of the words he was saying were Shannon Tweed. Mark lingered on the periphery, waiting for the guy to get off the phone.
Yeah, what do you want?
Hey, my name's Mark Dalton. I've got your wind machines on the back of my truck.
Never mind. The guy's here right now. What took you so long?
Shipping bill said Friday. Today's Friday.
Yeah, well, I could have used them this morning.
Then you should have asked for them on Thursday.
Yeah.
Are you the director?
Sort of. I'm the second unit director. Steve Zaks. I'm directing all the snowstorm scenes.
Where'd you want me to bring the wind machines, then?
I'll draw you a map.
Mark went over to the bar, and Steve drew a simple map that would take him to the site of tomorrow's shoot. A tree-lined hill midway between Collingwood and Stayner.
Look, there are a few trucks on the road now waiting for the site to be cleared. Pull in behind the last one in the line and wait there. I'll be up later to supervise the setup.
Can you sign for the load?
No, the production manager's up there. She'll sign when the machines are in position. Is there a problem?
No, not really. I hear Shannon Tweed is in this movie.
That's right.
Will she be there?
She did 2 days on location a week ago. Then she did 2 weeks in studio in Toronto. She's probably back in L.A. by now and working on her tan.
Oh, thanks.
It was a short drive to the location shoot, and Mark had no trouble finding the other trucks parked on the side of the road that led to the site. There was a semi-trailer up front, and a Kenworth medium-duty cab over directly in front of him. The engines were running on both trucks, so Mark decided to let his Peterbilt idle while he caught up on the local news with a copy of the Barry Examiner he'd picked up at a coffee shop about a half hour outside of Collingwood. Apparently, the movie production was big news. What with the ski season just about over and still a few months to go before the summer crowd descended on the area. A few cars drove by in both directions while Mark read the paper, but there was no sign of movement from the lead truck, so Mark lost himself in the news. He made it halfway through the paper when he heard the familiar cry of a Cummins, then looked up to see a plume of black smoke rise up from the lead rig's twin stacks. Mark shifted into first and waited for the truck in front of him to start moving. He waited there as the lead truck pulled away and disappeared around a curve in the road. But the truck directly in front of him didn't budge.
Come on, pal. Hey, buddy. The clutch is on the left and the gear shift is that long thing on the right with the knob on the end of it.
Pleased with his own joke, Mark waited for a response, but he didn't get one. He tried again, this time reaching up and grabbing the driver's jacket sleeve, hoping to get his attention.
Listen, man,
The driver tumbled out of the open cab into Mark's arms. His eyes were wide open and glassy, and his face was pale white, as if it had been drained of blood. Mark eased the man to the ground, then saw the knife handle sticking out of a bloody hole in the man's chest. Mark looked up and saw that there was blood dripping out of the truck cab, and was likely pooled all over the floor of it.
AD.
Hang on, pal. I'll call for an ambulance.
Mark got up to head back to his rig where he left his cell phone, but he didn't even manage a step. Parked next to his rig was an OPP cruiser, lights flashing.
Drop the knife!
The cop's gun pointed directly at Mark's head. Mark wanted to say something, tell the cop it wasn't how it looked, but he decided it wasn't time to be difficult with the police. He put down the knife, and moments later, he was in handcuffs. The interview room at the OPP Communication Center in Barrie was small, cramped, and surprisingly clean. Mark had expected something right out of NYPD Blue, But then this was rural Ontario, and such rooms probably didn't get as much use as their counterparts in Midtown Manhattan.
You were caught with the knife in your hand. There were no other fingerprints on the knife handle but yours.
I was pulling the knife out of the man's chest.
After you stuck it in?
No, I didn't stab him.
Just tell me why you did it.
I didn't kill him.
All right then, tell me what did happen.
I've already told you 12 times.
Let's make it lucky 13.
After I arrived at the inn, I was told by the second unit director to drive up to the location.
He recounted the story just as it happened, never stumbling over any of the details, never changing anything about the story. It was easy, since when you're telling the truth, the story is the same each and every time you tell it.
All right. He died in the ambulance on the way to the hospital, which means he was still alive when you found him. Did he say anything to you?
Mark hadn't mentioned it up until now because what the man had said seemed to be gibberish, and the cop hadn't yet asked him anything other than why he killed the man. Now that it seemed like the cop was willing to admit that he wasn't the killer, Mark was more inclined to help him with the case and tell him about the dying man's last words.
I can't be sure. He said something that sounded like aid or 80 or something like that.
You sure?
That's what it sounded like to me.
Any idea about what it's supposed to mean?
I don't know. He knew he was dying. Maybe he was saying adios.
D'Alessandro shook his head, obviously not appreciating Mark's line of reasoning.
You might want to take a look at this, Joe.
According to this, you're fairly well acquainted with a number of police forces across the country.
Okay, so I've been mixed up in a few things I shouldn't have, but come on, guys. I've never been charged with anything close to murder, not even assault.
The two cops looked at each other and seemed willing to concede the point. Mark sensed he was getting somewhere with D'Alessandro and decided to keep talking.
Most of the times, I wind up helping the cops.
Like in Vancouver a few days ago?
And as far as this guy who got killed goes...
Josh Peden.
As far as this Josh Peden goes, I never met him before, so I've got no motive. I just arrived in Collingwood, so I had no opportunity to plan a murder. And if I did do it, I would have used the bat I keep in my truck, not a knife.
Mark immediately regretted mentioning this last little bit, but nevertheless, it seemed to help make his point.
Don't go anywhere.
D'Alessandro followed the other cop out of the room. Mark sat for 2 hours trying to put what little pieces he had together. Finally, D'Alessandro returned to release him.
We might need to talk to you again about this case. Don't leave town.
Hey, I'm a trucker. It's my job to leave town.
Then I guess you're going to be out of a job for a while.
The police were kind enough to drive Mark back to his rig. It was still sitting there by the side of the road, the wind machine still up on the flatbed.
You Mark Dalton?
Yeah, who are you?
Karen Fernandez.
Ah, you're supposed to sign for my load.
I'd be happy to do that for you, but I want to talk to you about something else first.
I didn't do it.
I didn't say you did.
All right then.
Look, the cops mentioned to me that they didn't want you going anywhere for a while.
Yeah?
Yeah, so I was wondering if you might want to work for us as a driver for a few days. As you know, we're suddenly short one driver.
What kind of driving would I have to do?
You'd be moving the wind machines around to wherever we need them for one, but mostly you'd be driving one of the vans that shuttle our people from the inn to the location shoots.
Mark wanted to jump at the chance at hanging around a movie set for a few days, but didn't want to look too eager.
So what's it pay?
It's not union scale, but this is a non-union shoot. That's good for you, because I wouldn't be able to hire you otherwise.
Union or non-union, it was more than he would have been making sitting around waiting for the cops to let him leave town.
Yeah, sure, I guess that'd be all right.
Good. Now, let's get these wind machines off the road and onto the site.
After Mark got the wind machines on site, he left his rig at the location and got a ride back to the inn from one of the other shuttle bus drivers. When he got to the inn, the production manager's assistant gave him the keys to a 10-year-old Chrysler Magic Wagon parked out behind the inn.
Now what do I do?
Get the motor running and wait out front. You'll basically be shuttling people back and forth from the chute, or anywhere else they need to go.
It sounded easy enough, and it was always nice to carry a load that didn't have his fingerprints all over it.
If you're hungry, you can pick up something with the rest of the crew, but if you're not around when they break for lunch, you're on your own. Away you go, then.
Mark went to the lot behind the inn, where he saw the older minivan parked in among some newer vehicles. As he approached, he realized the van had been a school bus at one point and had probably seen better days. And that became painfully obvious when he got in behind the wheel and tried to start it up. Mark made a mental note, not to shut off the engine if he didn't have to, and maybe take a look under the hood if he had time. He was kept waiting out in front of the inn for 15 minutes, but that gave the van a chance to warm up both inside and under the hood. His first passengers were a pair of young women in neat little ski outfits that had been ripped and torn by the costume people. The women had also been made up and featured blue frostbitten lips and rough red scrapes on their faces and cuts and bruises to the rest of their exposed flesh. After the girls got in, one of them tried pulling the sliding door shut, but it wasn't closing right. Mark got out of the van, went around to the passenger side, and shut the door. When he got back into the van, the girls were talking about the dead driver. Mark listened in.
He was so cute.
I heard he was with Adriana Spencer.
But she's with the director.
She is now, but she had a fling with the driver before him.
Well, I can't blame her.
Did you hear they arrested the driver's partner?
They did?
Sure did. He had a set of keys to the truck, and they'd had a fight in the bar just last night. I saw that myself.
What's his name?
Who, the dead guy?
No, his partner.
I think it's Arnold Dickens.
Mark felt the hairs stand up on the back of his neck. A.D. had been the dying man's last words. Arnold Dickens. A.D. A.D. When he reached the location of the chute, he dropped off the girls and picked up an electrician who he had to drive to Barrie to pick up some supplies.
Shouldn't you have those things on site?
We should, and on any other chute we would, but the producer's been cutting every nickel and dime on this one.
Look, I don't know much about movies, but it looks to me as though there's plenty of money being thrown around.
Well, he's spending plenty of money on some things, like 2 weeks' work from Shen and Tweed, like the wind machine rental, but he went non-union to cut down on crew costs. This guy makes Roger Corman look like a fat cat, and I wouldn't be surprised if he's in trouble with the film board when this is all over.
Maybe the driver had something on the producer and was going to report him. That might ruin the guy's career, and that was certainly a motive for murder.
What's this producer's name?
Adianus. Joseph H. Adianus.
Mark shifted nervously in his seat. Joseph H. Adianus. Adianus. A.D. After returning from Barrie and dropping the electrician on location, he was sent back to the inn to pick up the stuntman who was the star of the scene they were about to shoot. But while Mark was expecting a stuntman, he actually picked up a man who bore a striking resemblance to Shannon Tweed.
No offense, pal, but you remind me a lot of Shannon Tweed.
Then 3 hours in makeup didn't go to waste.
The gruff voice was all out of sync with the voluptuous curves of his ski suit, the long blonde locks, and his ruby red lips.
Are you doing a stunt for her?
Nah, I'm taking a fall for the woman who plays Tweed's younger sister in the movie. It's just a 5-foot fall into a snowbank, but the director doesn't want to risk his new piece getting hurt.
His new girlfriend? You mean the one that had been with the dead truck driver?
Yeah, I guess she's the one. Seems like the kind that might get tired of a man after a while.
But she's been with the director for some time now.
Couple of days, a week maybe.
If you don't mind me asking, who is the director anyway?
You kidding me? Abram Doyle Kelso. He did Newts in Your Pants?
Oh, him.
Abram Doyle Kelso. Abram Doyle. A.D. When he reached the site, Mark was asked to wait a few minutes for someone. He waited 10 minutes before a young actress got into the van. She had trouble closing the sliding door, so Mark had to get out and help her get it shut. She was pretty enough to be a star, and he could swear that he'd seen her somewhere before.
Are you one of the stars in this movie?
Not of this movie, sugar.
I sense a sarcastic tone.
It's just that I'm not about to make a name for myself by sleeping with the director. It might take a bit longer, but I'm going to make it on my talent.
You mean like the woman who's with the director now?
How did you know? She's an ambitious one. She'd give it up for anyone who she thinks can advance her career. Can you believe it? She even slept with one of the drivers because he told her he was a good friend of another director.
How do you know that?
You think he didn't try the line on me?
But she's with the director now, and she got a better part, right?
Yeah, she got the part, but her kind will do anything to be in the movies. It worked this time, but she doesn't have the talent to back it up. She might be Doyle's plaything this week, but next week someone else will be playing that role.
Plenty of women like her, huh?
Mister, I know a dozen girls who would kill to get a better part in a movie.
Really? What's this woman's name? You know, so I'll know it when the movie comes out.
Adriana Spencer, with an S like the private eye.
Adriana, A.D. Mark shook his head. Who wasn't a suspect? After a good night's sleep at the inn, Mark was up early running errands before he was scheduled to start shuttling people back and forth from the location. After picking up some dry cleaning in Barry, he decided to see if he could see the truck driver they had in custody. It was a long shot, but if he could convince the police that he knew this driver, they might let him see him.
Hi, I'm Mark Dalton. I replaced the driver that was killed. I need to speak to the driver you've charged with the other's murder.
Are you a friend of his?
Mark wondered what to say. He didn't even know the guy's name.
No. It's just that I've got to move his truck, and I can't find the reverse on it. I need to ask him, you know, where it is.
The look on the officer's face said, "What kind of truck driver are you?" Mark realized he had to bore the man with detail.
Yeah, you see, on a Peterbilt, the gear configuration is similar to that.
McNeil!
Yeah? Take this guy to see that driver we charged with murder. Give him 2 minutes, then show him the door.
The younger cop nodded, and Mark was on his way.
You a lawyer?
No, just a driver.
I need a lawyer to get me out of here.
Well, I might just get you out of here just the same.
What do you want?
I want to know about your partner.
Know what?
Like, was he having money problems?
With this job, we were doing great. The pay's good. We're not putting any miles in the trucks. Josh said he wanted to buy another rig, hire a third driver, and start to make our little company grow. We had money, sure, but not enough for a new rig. But Josh says not to worry, and he'll be coming into some money soon, so financing wasn't going to be a problem.
Where was he going to get the money from?
I don't know. He didn't really have a head for money. See, he was a good-looking guy, but dumb as a post. Where he got into trouble all the time was with women. Like with that actress? Her so young and pretty, and him so big and dumb. If I were the cops, I'd take a look at her.
So, reverse is on the right, then down in the corner.
Huh?
Got it, thanks.
The cop led him out of the station. When he got into the van, he thought about what he'd learned. So the driver, Josh, was expecting a windfall of cash. And then he's dead. And somehow the girl was involved. But how? Mark didn't have to wonder for long. His first passenger of the day was the very girl in question, Adriana Spencer. She was young, really young, pretty too, and had a body that was every bit as curvaceous as Shannon Tweed's. That was obvious even though she was wearing a ski suit. No wonder the director had taken a shine to her.
Morning. You're Adriana Spencer, right?
That's right. Hi, Mom. No, they're not doing anything to celebrate it. Doyle doesn't want to make a big deal about it. He says we'll be celebrating in Cancun after the film wraps.
Mom, you're breaking up. I'll call you later.
Celebrating a birthday?
Yes.
How old are you, if you don't mind me asking?
How old do you have to be to drink in Ontario?
19.
Then that's how old I am, 19.
Oh, so you're born in 1972, huh?
That's right.
Mark didn't really think he'd catch her so easily, but there it was. If she was 19, she'd have corrected him and said 1971. But she agreed she was born in 1972, which made today her 18th birthday, and which also made her just 17 the day before. No wonder the director, Doyle, didn't want to make a big deal about her birthday. And no wonder the driver, Josh, had been murdered. When he arrived at the location, Mark dropped Adriana Spencer off.
Happy birthday, and break a leg.
He took a few extras back to the inn, and then picked up the second unit director, Steve Zax, to take him out to the location as well. He seemed to be in a hurry, and a little bit on edge.
You're the second unit director, right? I met you yesterday.
Yeah, hi.
I've only been working in movies for a day, but I've learned that sometimes the second unit director is also called the assistant director.
Boy, you learn fast.
But not too many people call it assistant director. They just call it AD.
That's me.
Huh. So how's the movie going?
Very well, actually. 2 more days of shooting, and then 2 weeks editing, and it'll all be done. And I'll be back here in December, shooting Snowflake 2.
You know that already, huh? Doesn't the first one have to make money first?
See, the way we shot it on the cheap, it's already turned a profit with rights sales to Japan, Russia, and Brazil. The deal for the sequel was inked yesterday, and I'm going to direct it.
Dalton felt a chill creep up the back of his spine.
So I guess it was really important to you that this shoot went off without a hitch, right?
Yes.
And the murder of that driver was probably a close one in terms of the movie getting finished and all.
What do you mean?
Well, any adverse publicity and the whole production might get shut down. The movie would be left hanging and there'd be no Snowflake 2. No Big Break for you.
I suppose.
So, if there was something that might screw up the film, you'd really want to make it right.
What the hell are you getting at?
Like, if that driver was going to blackmail you about how the director was sleeping with a minor, that could throw the whole movie into the toilet. What with all the nudity in it.
Shut the hell up!
Hey, I'm just talking here.
But the AD was through talking. He had a knife in his hand now, much like the knife Mark had pulled from the dead man's chest. Mark turned the wheel wildly, left and right, trying to throw the man in the backseat off balance. It was working, but only a little. The sliding door had rolled open, and the man's knife was ripping through the driver's seat, coming dangerously close to Mark's arm. Mark leaned forward in the seat and could hear the knife tearing through the backrest behind him. He'd only been asking a few questions, trying to figure out the puzzle in his head. He never dreamed he would stumble upon the murderer, and right now he wished to God his involvement in the movie business consisted of popcorn, soda, and an aisle seat. The guy was still slashing wildly at him from the back seat. The only thing saving Mark's life was the fact that the man wasn't wearing a seatbelt and couldn't hold the knife steadily enough to deal a lethal blow.
That damn idiot Doyle! I told him, keep it in your pants till her birthday! But he couldn't resist that bitch! Never once thought about me, my career!
Another slash tore into the seat behind Mark, and he could feel the knife tip press against the small of his back. The next one was going to go right through the seat. He began honking the horn since he was rapidly approaching the chute. There were a couple of people milling around, even a couple of cops on hand to keep an eye on things. Mark stepped on the gas and headed for the police and their cruiser. People began to scatter. About 50 yards away from the cruiser, Mark turned the wheel hard to the left and jumped on the brake pedal with both feet. The minivan's rear end swung out as the tires screamed against the asphalt. For a moment, it looked as if the vehicle might topple over. But then it came to an abrupt halt, sending Steve Zaks, AD, flying out the open door like a drunk after closing time. He rolled head over heels over head several times before coming to a halt at the feet of two constables. Mark knew right then that his career in the movies was finished. And he was glad of it.
Be sure to look for the next episode of Mark Dalton, Owner Operator. In August, Mark Dalton Episode 6 appears in Deathlands No. 25, The Executioner No. 319, and Doomsday Warrior No. 3.
Can't find that hot graphic audio title you're looking for? Just head to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD or MP3 disc format. Or, the fastest and cheapest way, download that puppy and play it on any of the many devices that'll play Windows Media. And if you're on the road or just a total computer feeb, snatch up the phone and call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.
Graphic Audio presents Mark Dalton, Owner-Operator, by Ido Van Belkom. Copyright 2007, Ido Van Belkom. Performed by David Coyne and the Graphic Audio Players. Episode 5, Murder on Sight.
The drive back east across the prairies was uneventful, and considering the string of adventures he'd experienced of late, Mark Dalton was grateful for the respite. When he reached Sudbury, he made a call on his cell phone to find out exactly where he was supposed to deliver the wind machines to, and to make sure there would be someone to meet him when he got there later in the day. The movie was being shot in and around Collingwood, and the cast and crew had taken over an inn just a few kilometers away in a town called Nottawa. That's where he was supposed to deliver his load. When he got to the inn around 3 that afternoon, he parked on the road out in front of the place and headed inside. He was on the lookout for Shannon Tweed, the sexy star of the movie, but figured she was probably on the set somewhere, acting up a storm.
I'll call you later.
Still, maybe he'd get lucky. The production company had taken over the inn's lobby, using it like a command center. There was a storyboard on one wall, filming schedules on another, and a few tables with clipboards and other items that looked like they helped keep track of things. But for all the clutter in the room, there wasn't a soul in sight.
Hello? Anybody here? Hello?
From a room off the lobby, he could hear someone talking, probably on a phone because the shouts were punctuated by long pauses. Mark headed for the sound of the voice and ended up in the inn's bar. There was a young man sitting on a stool with a cell phone to his ear. He was talking about a lot of things Mark didn't understand or cared about, since none of the words he was saying were Shannon Tweed. Mark lingered on the periphery, waiting for the guy to get off the phone.
Yeah, what do you want?
Hey, my name's Mark Dalton. I've got your wind machines on the back of my truck.
Never mind. The guy's here right now. What took you so long?
Shipping bill said Friday. Today's Friday.
Yeah, well, I could have used them this morning.
Then you should have asked for them on Thursday.
Yeah.
Are you the director?
Sort of. I'm the second unit director. Steve Zaks. I'm directing all the snowstorm scenes.
Where'd you want me to bring the wind machines, then?
I'll draw you a map.
Mark went over to the bar, and Steve drew a simple map that would take him to the site of tomorrow's shoot. A tree-lined hill midway between Collingwood and Stayner.
Look, there are a few trucks on the road now waiting for the site to be cleared. Pull in behind the last one in the line and wait there. I'll be up later to supervise the setup.
Can you sign for the load?
No, the production manager's up there. She'll sign when the machines are in position. Is there a problem?
No, not really. I hear Shannon Tweed is in this movie.
That's right.
Will she be there?
She did 2 days on location a week ago. Then she did 2 weeks in studio in Toronto. She's probably back in L.A. by now and working on her tan.
Oh, thanks.
It was a short drive to the location shoot, and Mark had no trouble finding the other trucks parked on the side of the road that led to the site. There was a semi-trailer up front, and a Kenworth medium-duty cab over directly in front of him. The engines were running on both trucks, so Mark decided to let his Peterbilt idle while he caught up on the local news with a copy of the Barry Examiner he'd picked up at a coffee shop about a half hour outside of Collingwood. Apparently, the movie production was big news. What with the ski season just about over and still a few months to go before the summer crowd descended on the area. A few cars drove by in both directions while Mark read the paper, but there was no sign of movement from the lead truck, so Mark lost himself in the news. He made it halfway through the paper when he heard the familiar cry of a Cummins, then looked up to see a plume of black smoke rise up from the lead rig's twin stacks. Mark shifted into first and waited for the truck in front of him to start moving. He waited there as the lead truck pulled away and disappeared around a curve in the road. But the truck directly in front of him didn't budge.
Come on, pal. Hey, buddy. The clutch is on the left and the gear shift is that long thing on the right with the knob on the end of it.
Pleased with his own joke, Mark waited for a response, but he didn't get one. He tried again, this time reaching up and grabbing the driver's jacket sleeve, hoping to get his attention.
Listen, man, I...
The driver tumbled out of the open cab into Mark's arms. His eyes were wide open and glassy, and his face was pale white, as if it had been drained of blood. Mark eased the man to the ground, then saw the knife handle sticking out of a bloody hole in the man's chest. Mark looked up and saw that there was blood dripping out of the truck cab, and was likely pooled all over the floor of it.
AD...
Hang on, pal. I'll call for an ambulance.
Mark got up to head back to his rig where he left his cell phone, but he didn't even manage a step. Parked next to his rig was an OPP cruiser, lights flashing.
Drop the knife!
The cop's gun pointed directly at Mark's head. Mark wanted to say something, tell the cop it wasn't how it looked, but he decided it wasn't time to be difficult with the police. He put down the knife, and moments later, he was in handcuffs. The interview room at the OPP Communication Center in Barrie was small, cramped, and surprisingly clean. Mark had expected something right out of NYPD Blue, But then this was rural Ontario, and such rooms probably didn't get as much use as their counterparts in Midtown Manhattan.
You were caught with the knife in your hand. There were no other fingerprints on the knife handle but yours.
I was pulling the knife out of the man's chest.
After you stuck it in?
No, I didn't stab him.
Just tell me why you did it.
I didn't kill him.
All right then, tell me what did happen.
I've already told you 12 times.
Let's make it lucky 13.
After I arrived at the inn, I was told by the second unit director to drive up to the location.
He recounted the story just as it happened, never stumbling over any of the details, never changing anything about the story. It was easy, since when you're telling the truth, the story is the same each and every time you tell it.
All right. He died in the ambulance on the way to the hospital, which means he was still alive when you found him. Did he say anything to you?
Mark hadn't mentioned it up until now because what the man had said seemed to be gibberish, and the cop hadn't yet asked him anything other than why he killed the man. Now that it seemed like the cop was willing to admit that he wasn't the killer, Mark was more inclined to help him with the case and tell him about the dying man's last words.
I can't be sure. He said something that sounded like aid or 80 or something like that.
You sure?
That's what it sounded like to me.
Any idea about what it's supposed to mean?
I don't know. He knew he was dying. Maybe he was saying adios.
D'Alessandro shook his head, obviously not appreciating Mark's line of reasoning.
You might want to take a look at this, Joe.
According to this, you're fairly well acquainted with a number of police forces across the country.
Okay, so I've been mixed up in a few things I shouldn't have, but come on, guys. I've never been charged with anything close to murder, not even assault.
The two cops looked at each other and seemed willing to concede the point. Mark sensed he was getting somewhere with D'Alessandro and decided to keep talking.
Most of the times, I wind up helping the cops.
Like in Vancouver a few days ago?
And as far as this guy who got killed goes...
Josh Peden.
As far as this Josh Peden goes, I never met him before, so I've got no motive. I just arrived in Collingwood, so I had no opportunity to plan a murder. And if I did do it, I would have used the bat I keep in my truck, not a knife.
Mark immediately regretted mentioning this last little bit, but nevertheless, it seemed to help make his point.
Don't go anywhere.
D'Alessandro followed the other cop out of the room. Mark sat for 2 hours trying to put what little pieces he had together. Finally, D'Alessandro returned to release him.
We might need to talk to you again about this case. Don't leave town.
Hey, I'm a trucker. It's my job to leave town.
Then I guess you're going to be out of a job for a while.
The police were kind enough to drive Mark back to his rig. It was still sitting there by the side of the road, the wind machine still up on the flatbed.
You Mark Dalton?
Yeah, who are you?
Karen Fernandez.
Ah, you're supposed to sign for my load.
I'd be happy to do that for you, but I want to talk to you about something else first.
I didn't do it.
I didn't say you did.
All right then.
Look, the cops mentioned to me that they didn't want you going anywhere for a while.
Yeah?
Yeah, so I was wondering if you might want to work for us as a driver for a few days. As you know, we're suddenly short one driver.
What kind of driving would I have to do?
You'd be moving the wind machines around to wherever we need them for one, but mostly you'd be driving one of the vans that shuttle our people from the inn to the location shoots.
Mark wanted to jump at the chance at hanging around a movie set for a few days, but didn't want to look too eager.
So what's it pay?
It's not union scale, but this is a non-union shoot. That's good for you, because I wouldn't be able to hire you otherwise.
Union or non-union, it was more than he would have been making sitting around waiting for the cops to let him leave town.
Yeah, sure, I guess that'd be all right.
Good. Now, let's get these wind machines off the road and onto the site.
After Mark got the wind machines on site, he left his rig at the location and got a ride back to the inn from one of the other shuttle bus drivers. When he got to the inn, the production manager's assistant gave him the keys to a 10-year-old Chrysler Magic Wagon parked out behind the inn.
Now what do I do?
Get the motor running and wait out front. You'll basically be shuttling people back and forth from the chute, or anywhere else they need to go.
It sounded easy enough, and it was always nice to carry a load that didn't have his fingerprints all over it.
If you're hungry, you can pick up something with the rest of the crew, but if you're not around when they break for lunch, you're on your own. Away you go, then.
Mark went to the lot behind the inn, where he saw the older minivan parked in among some newer vehicles. As he approached, he realized the van had been a school bus at one point and had probably seen better days. And that became painfully obvious when he got in behind the wheel and tried to start it up. Mark made a mental note, not to shut off the engine if he didn't have to, and maybe take a look under the hood if he had time. He was kept waiting out in front of the inn for 15 minutes, but that gave the van a chance to warm up both inside and under the hood. His first passengers were a pair of young women in neat little ski outfits that had been ripped and torn by the costume people. The women had also been made up and featured blue frostbitten lips and rough red scrapes on their faces and cuts and bruises to the rest of their exposed flesh. After the girls got in, one of them tried pulling the sliding door shut, but it wasn't closing right. Mark got out of the van, went around to the passenger side, and shut the door. When he got back into the van, the girls were talking about the dead driver. Mark listened in.
He was so cute.
I heard he was with Adriana Spencer.
But she's with the director.
She is now, but she had a fling with the driver before him.
Well, I can't blame her.
Did you hear they arrested the driver's partner?
They did?
Sure did. He had a set of keys to the truck, and they'd had a fight in the bar just last night. I saw that myself.
What's his name?
Who, the dead guy?
No, his partner.
I think it's Arnold Dickens?
Mark felt the hairs stand up on the back of his neck. A.D. had been the dying man's last words. Arnold Dickens. A.D. A.D. When he reached the location of the chute, he dropped off the girls and picked up an electrician who he had to drive to Barry to pick up some supplies.
Shouldn't you have those things on site?
We should, and on any other shoot we would, but the producer's been cutting every nickel and dime on this one.
Look, I don't know much about movies, but it looks to me as though there's plenty of money being thrown around.
Well, he's spending plenty of money on some things, like 2 weeks' work from Shen and Tweed, like the wind machine rental, but he went non-union to cut down on crew costs. This guy makes Roger Corman look like a fat cat. And I wouldn't be surprised if he's in trouble with the film board when this is all over.
Maybe the driver had something on the producer and was going to report him. That might ruin the guy's career, and that was certainly a motive for murder.
What's this producer's name?
Adianus. Joseph H. Adianus.
Mark shifted nervously in his seat. Joseph H. Adianus. Adianus. A.D. After returning from Barry and dropping the electrician on location, he was sent back to the inn to pick up the stuntman who was the star of the scene they were about to shoot. But while Mark was expecting a stuntman, he actually picked up a man who bore a striking resemblance to Shannon Tweed.
No offense, pal, but you remind me a lot of Shannon Tweed.
Then 3 hours in makeup didn't go to waste.
The gruff voice was all out of sync with the voluptuous curves of his ski suit, the long blonde locks, and his ruby red lips.
Are you doing a stunt for her?
Nah. I'm taking a fall for the woman who plays Tweedjunger's sister in the movie. It's just a 5-foot fall into a snowbank, but the director doesn't want to risk his new piece getting hurt.
His new girlfriend? You mean the one that had been with the dead truck driver?
Yeah, I guess she's the one. Seems like the kind that might get tired of a man after a while.
But she's been with the director for some time now.
Couple of days, a week maybe.
If you don't mind me asking, who is the director anyway?
You kidding me? Abram Doyle Kelso. He did Newts in Your Pants?
Oh, him.
Avram Doyle Kelso. Avram Doyle. A.D. When he reached the site, Mark was asked to wait a few minutes for someone. He waited 10 minutes before a young actress got into the van. She had trouble closing the sliding door, so Mark had to get out and help her get it shut. She was pretty enough to be a star, and he could swear that he'd seen her somewhere before.
Are you one of the stars in this movie?
Not of this movie, sugar.
I sense a sarcastic tone.
It's just that I'm not about to make a name for myself by sleeping with the director. It might take a bit longer, but I'm going to make it on my talent.
You mean like the woman who's with the director now?
How did you know? She's an ambitious one. She'd give it up for anyone who she thinks can advance her career. Can you believe it? She even slept with one of the drivers because he told her he was a good friend of another director.
How do you know that?
You think he didn't try the line on me?
But she's with the director now, and she got a better part, right?
Yeah, she got the part, but her kind will do anything to be in the movies. It worked this time, but she doesn't have the talent to back it up. She might be Doyle's plaything this week, but next week, someone else will be playing that role.
Plenty of women like her, huh?
Mister, I know a dozen girls who would kill to get a better part in a movie.
Really? What's this woman's name? You know, so I'll know it when the movie comes out.
Adriana Spencer, with an S like the private eye.
Adriana, A.D. Mark shook his head. Who wasn't a suspect? After a good night's sleep at the inn, Mark was up early running errands before he was scheduled to start shuttling people back and forth from the location. After picking up some dry cleaning in Barry, he decided to see if he could see the truck driver they had in custody. It was a long shot, but if he could convince the police that he knew this driver, they might let him see him.
Hi, I'm Mark Dalton. I replaced the driver that was killed. I need to speak to the driver you've charged with the other's murder.
Are you a friend of his?
Mark wondered what to say. He didn't even know the guy's name.
No. It's just that I've got to move his truck, and I can't find the reverse on it. I need to ask him, where it is.
The look on the officer's face said, "What kind of truck driver are you?" Mark realized he had to bore the man with details.
Yeah, you see, on a Peterbilt, the gear configuration is similar to that.
McNeil!
Yeah? Take this guy to see that driver we charged with murder. Give him 2 minutes, then show him the door.
The younger cop nodded, and Mark was on his way.
You a lawyer?
No, just a driver.
I need a lawyer to get me out of here.
Well, I might just get you out of here just the same.
What do you want?
I want to know about your partner.
Know what?
Like, was he having money problems?
With this job, we were doing great. The pay's good. We're not putting any miles in the trucks. Josh said he wanted to buy another rig, hire a third driver, and start to make our little company grow. We had money, sure, but not enough for a new rig. But Josh says not to worry, and he'll be coming into some money soon, so financing wasn't going to be a problem.
Where was he going to get the money from?
I don't know. He didn't really have a head for money. See, he was a good-looking guy, but dumb as a post. Where he got into trouble all the time was with women, like with that actress. Her so young and pretty, and him so big and dumb. If I were the cops, I'd take a look at her.
So, reverse is on the right, then down in the corner.
Huh?
Got it, thanks.
The cop led him out of the station. When he got into the van, he thought about what he'd learned. So the driver, Josh, was expecting a windfall of cash. And then he's dead. And somehow the girl was involved. But how? Mark didn't have to wonder for long. His first passenger of the day was the very girl in question, Adriana Spencer. She was young, really young, pretty too, and had a body that was every bit as curvaceous as Shannon Tweed's. That was obvious even though she was wearing a ski suit. No wonder the director had taken a shine to her.
Morning. You're Adriana Spencer, right?
That's right. Hi, Mom. No, they're not doing anything to celebrate it. Doyle doesn't want to make a big deal about it. He says we'll be celebrating in Cancun after the film wraps.
Mom, you're breaking up. I'll call you later.
Celebrating a birthday?
Yes.
How old are you, if you don't mind me asking?
How old do you have to be to drink in Ontario?
19.
Then that's how old I am, 19.
Oh, so you're born in 1972, huh?
That's right.
Mark didn't really think he'd catch her so easily, but there it was. If she was 19, she'd have corrected him and said 1971. But she agreed she was born in 1972, which made today her 18th birthday, and which also made her just 17 the day before. No wonder the director, Doyle, didn't want to make a big deal about her birthday. And no wonder the driver, Josh, had been murdered. When he arrived at the location, Mark dropped Adriana Spencer off.
Happy birthday, and break a leg.
He took a few extras back to the inn, and then picked up the second unit director, Steve Zacks, to take him out to the location as well. He seemed to be in a hurry, and a little bit on edge.
You're the second unit director, right? I met you yesterday.
Yeah, hi.
I've only been working in movies for a day, but I've learned that sometimes the second unit director is also called the assistant director.
Boy, you learn fast.
But not too many people call it assistant director. They just call it AD.
That's me.
Huh. So how's the movie going?
Very well, actually. 2 more days of shooting, and then 2 weeks editing, and it'll all be done. And I'll be back here in December, shooting Snowflake 2.
You know that already, huh? Doesn't the first one have to make money first?
See, the way we shot it on the cheap, it's already turned a profit with rights sales to Japan, Russia, and Brazil. The deal for the sequel was inked yesterday, and I'm going to direct it.
Dalton felt a chill creep up the back of his spine.
So I guess it was really important to you that this shoot went off without a hitch, right?
Yes.
And the murder of that driver was probably a close one in terms of the movie getting finished and all.
What do you mean?
Well, any adverse publicity and the whole production might get shut down. The movie would be left hanging and there'd be no Snowflake 2. No big break for you.
I suppose.
So, if there was something that might screw up the film, you'd really want to make it right.
What the hell are you getting at?
Like, if that driver was going to blackmail you about how the director was sleeping with a minor, that could throw the whole movie into the toilet. What with all the nudity in it.
Shut the hell up!
Hey, I'm just talking here.
But the AD was through talking. He had a knife in his hand now, much like the knife Mark had pulled from the dead man's chest. Mark turned the wheel wildly, left and right, trying to throw the man in the back seat off balance. It was working, but only a little. The sliding door had rolled open, and the man's knife was ripping through the driver's seat, coming dangerously close to Mark's arm. Mark leaned forward in the seat and could hear the knife tearing through the backrest behind him. He'd only been asking a few questions, trying to figure out the puzzle in his head. He never dreamed he would stumble upon the murderer, and right now he wished to God his involvement in the movie business consisted of popcorn, soda, and an aisle seat. The guy was still slashing wildly at him from the back seat. The only thing saving Mark's life was the fact that the man wasn't wearing a seatbelt and couldn't hold the knife steadily enough to deal a lethal blow.
That damn idiot Doyle! I told him, keep it in your pants till her birthday! But he couldn't resist that bitch! Never once thought about me, my career!
Another slash tore into the seat behind Mark, and he could feel the knife tip press against the small of his back. The next one was going to go right through the seat. He began honking the horn since he was rapidly approaching the chute. There were a couple of people milling around, even a couple of cops on hand to keep an eye on things. Mark stepped on the gas and headed for the police and their cruiser. People began to scatter. About 50 yards away from the cruiser, Mark turned the wheel hard to the left and jumped on the brake pedal with both feet. The minivan's rear end swung out as the tires screamed against the asphalt. For a moment, it looked as if the vehicle might topple over. But then it came to an abrupt halt, sending Steve Zatz, AD, flying out the open door like a drunk after closing time. He rolled head over heels over head several times before coming to a halt at the feet of two constables. Mark knew right then that his career in the movies was finished. And he was glad of it.
Be sure to look for the next episode of Mark Dalton, Owner Operator. In August, Mark Dalton Episode 6 appears in Deathlands No. 25, The Executioner No. 319, and Doomsday Warrior No. 3.
Find that hot graphic audio title you're looking for, just head to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD or MP3 disc format. Or, the fastest and cheapest way, download that puppy and play it on any of the many devices that'll play Windows Media. And if you're on the road or just a total computer feeb, snatch up the phone and call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.